All right. We are back. Welcome to Patrick. Hey, it's me, Patrick Chappelle. Thanks for tuning in and listening again. This week on the podcast, you're going to hear from my friend, Brian Schroeder. Brian and I go way back. We talk about his life, his history, family, his college experiences, and his love for comics and hip hop. Yeah, it's a great episode. My hope is that while some of you that are listening may have zero clue who these people are, that the conversation that me and my guests are having is open enough and inclusive enough for you to pick up something, whether it's a different perspective, a different way of seeing the world, life, relationships, whatever it may be. And in the coming months, we'll have guests in different sectors and folks that I have no idea who they are, besides knowing the kind of work that they do in the world. That's kind of what's happening right now on the show. Last week, you heard from Tristan Wheeler, our first ever homily episode, and that was pretty awesome. And we'll occasionally have those in the mix each month where we'll drop a homily episode and it'll just launch right into it. There's no intro from me. There's no banter from Ben. We just hop right into the homily. So I hope you enjoyed that and so thankful for Tristan and his gift for speaking and storytelling. Other things to bring to your attention, if you haven't already, go ahead and subscribe to the podcast. Go ahead and rate it. And rating it is important because that helps people find us. Leave a comment, share on your social media. Tell a friend that may have never listened to a podcast that may find what we're doing here interesting. Also, follow us on Instagram. And the website is coming soon, too. Ben.
What's up?
What's up? How's it going in there?
It's going pretty well. I just found out something about spaghetti.
Oh, no.
I think is pretty interesting.
What? We are always doing this.
It was originally from China. And Marco Polo, in his exploration of Asia and discovering different things over there, he brought it back to Italy and it became the popular Italian dish.
So thank you, Marco Polo. All right, here's the show. Enjoy it. Hey, Brian.
Hey, what's up, Matt?
So, I'm in this show, and as I've said to a lot of people, I, especially in the beginning of this whole experiment that I'm doing in the podcast, I wanted to bring on and interview people that I think have interesting stories and interesting things to say that perhaps a lot of people have never met or heard of, but I think that could get a lot of benefit from hearing their story or their perspective, et cetera, et cetera. So that being said, here you are. So thanks for coming.
Yeah, here I am.
Yeah.
Thanks, man. Glad to be here. Glad to be included in that number of people that you want people to know.
So I guess the first thing would be just give us kind of the background, like you're from Nashville, right? Like, kind of give us the, you know, that freshman back when we were in college, that freshman, like, here's who
freshman
I am.
Orientation.
Yeah, here's who I am. Yeah. Here's my
totally
my stats, my background.
Yeah. This is the back of my baseball card.
Right, your back of your baseball card. That's good.
Yeah, I mean, I am a Nashville native, which is, I guess, more and more rare these days. Grew up here. I had very nerdy parents and very socially liberal parents and very church-going parents. And so that gives you a lot of what has like driven a lot of my life.
So
wait.
So you had nerdy.
Nerdy.
Social.
Socially liberal.
Socially liberal. Church-going parents.
Church-going parents.
And you were, I mean, that's pretty unique, right?
Yeah.
Especially in, like, being in Middle Tennessee.
Yeah. The South.
Mm-hmm. So what did that actually, like, what is that, those are great words, but what does that actually, what did they look like growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially the part for me that was really important was early in my church life. I noticed the dissonance, or at least I noticed the idea that a certain political ideology equals Christianity, and that my family didn't line up with that. But I'm pretty sure they're good Christians. So that's confusing, right?
Right.
You know, growing up in a very fundamentalist evangelical tradition that does say that, it's like my parents were a part of that tradition, but still believe very liberal kind of politics, right?
Yeah.
And so it just led early on to me questioning things maybe a little earlier than other people did. I think that's the biggest thing.
Huh.
Yeah. And the nerdy part. Sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, keep going. Yeah.
The nerdy part was just, you know, probably in line with that, just helped me ask those questions very critically, very, very critically early on.
So what was one of those first questions you remember as a kid that you asked?
Yeah, I mean, I know that my dad did a huge, I'm so grateful for him because I remember when I was 12, he talked to me about, and I can't remember the exact name of this thing, but he talked through, there's like, I want to say 32 or more of these like very specific scientific things that come together to make life on Earth work.
Right.
And there's all these, you know, all these scientific reasons that there's a creator behind everything. And so early on, I didn't see a disconnect between science and religion, right? Wow. Which a lot of people do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But for me, they kind of went together. And I'm almost like, you know, like that was so helpful for me as like a foundational piece that I never really questioned it. And so I was able to kind of move past it kind of quickly. Like I'm really grateful for him instilling that in me because I didn't have to worry about that when I got to college or when I was in biology class talking about evolution or whatever. Like it was just like, these things match up. These things are complementary of each other. They aren't antagonists. Right.
Yeah. So I guess then that makes me think of this question because so many people will grow up and they've been given this kind of way of viewing science and faith and politics and faith and community involvement and faith. And so it seems like the things that people experience perhaps in college, you grew up with, right? You didn't grow up with these like, oh, this is how science and faith actually work together. Oh, this is what we should be doing socially, justice-wise, as people of faith. So then what was it for you then? Because I feel like we all have that, we hit the brick wall or we get challenged in a way of how we were brought up.
Mm-hmm.
What was it for you?
Oh, wow. What I would say, at least in college for me, the big thing was, I remember thinking in high school, we don't know if Jesus said these words in the Bible, right? These were written hundreds of years after him is what I kind of got to at that point. What college actually did for me, which is almost the opposite of what a lot of my friends were feeling in college, I was like, oh, like this maybe was only written 90 years after Jesus was here. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's a lot closer than I thought it was.
Right, right.
That's like a generation or two, right?
Yeah.
And so I was like, I was actually, what I like to say is that I didn't come out of college more conservative, although I was trying to kind of get myself in line with some of the conservative circles that I ran in.
Mm-hmm.
So I would kind of talk that way. But mentally, Which is a whole other thing. But mentally, I was at a place where I'd like to say I got more orthodox in my understanding.
Right.
I got more comfortable with the Bible being a foundational piece of my beliefs.
Yeah.
Through studying it so intently during college. Because I majored in religion. I was curious about that. I was so curious about what is behind everything and can I trust this book? Can I trust what I grew up? You know, it was just that continued like critical questioning, beating on the door, asking like, wait, do we really believe? Can we really believe? And I got to a place after college where I was like, yeah, I think I can believe this. Right. I can be cool with this.
Huh.
Yeah.
So yeah, that, so you kind of alluded to it a little bit, but in your college life, you said you found yourself kind of connected to a little bit more conservative, traditional-minded groups of people, kind mm-hmm. of in your social settings and theology settings in that way. Like, so what do you think that was all about? How did you, how did that work with all of this kind of background that you have that's not that, but mm-hmm. now it's like, well, these are now my people. So how did you kind of navigate those waters? And I'm sure it was difficult at times, but.
Yeah, I think, so, you know, those were my waters even in high school a little bit.
Yeah.
But I went to an arts high school where I was exposed to so many people that were not conservative and not in that very fundamentalist world. And so, but I also went to church and was a part of the youth group. And so it's like, you know, 5 days a week I'm at school, four times a week I'm at church doing whatever. Mm-hmm. And like I had both of those kind of working together early on. And I found, you know, I would invite friends to youth group things from school. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know, and they were very different people, right? And some of them got in trouble on youth group trips, of course. And and so, you know, it was like, it was interesting to try. I was early on, and I still find myself doing this. I was really trying to figure out what are the bridges between these groups? Like, how can a conservative person really mesh with my gothic gay friend? Really,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Seriously,
that was like a real question that
that's
I had.
That's a good one, yeah.
And it was something that I brought to church a lot. And so college was almost for me, looking back, it really was kind of an immersion in like, who are these people that I am? Like, it comes fairly naturally for me to like be friends with and like get along with, like it's like the gothic kid or the, you know, the weird kid that I meet at the bar or whatever. But there is something that really rubs me the wrong way about a lot of like fundamentalist conservative stuff.
Yeah.
And the assumptions that come with that.
Yeah.
And there's assumptions on all sides. But that assumption, because I grew up with it and I know it well, really rubs me wrong. And so I think what Lipscomb growing up and going there, you know, that was the first time I ever had a curfew was when I lived on campus at my little private Christian school.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
And yeah. So it was wild. You know, it was just, it made no sense to me, but I was like, it was almost like a culture shock in a different way. And so I think that's what at least college did for me was that figuring out what is this group and naming things and naming what the ideology was.
Right.
Figuring out what is important to them, you know, almost as like an anthropologist, I guess, you know, like figuring out my roots there, being able to name it, being able to name the history and all that stuff, so that hopefully then I could kind of help bring them.
Be the bridge.
Along as, a bridge toward other groups of people.
So now theology is obviously a big piece of you mm-hmm. and what we talked about already, but art and this creative, you have this incredible creative side and artistic side. So how was that always like, was that baby Brian? Like, was he always drawing and,
yeah.
or yeah. So
really, yeah. I mean, I was always, there are all these, I've found them recently. There are all these notebooks full of like superheroes and like Disney characters and all these things that I was drawing very early on. And I had several, like, I had a whole universe of snowmen people when I was three that I was like, they're like fighting, and there's like a whole, I don't know what the narrative was completely, but it was, seemed pretty dope. And so, yeah, I mean, my, you know, part of my deep nerdiness is from my parents, because my parents met through the letter column in the back of the Superman comic books.
Stop it.
No, I will not. And so, like, my dad is very well known in like people who read the letter columns at that time, like in the 70s, is as Angry Al Schroeder. And he would write in and he would say, well, you know, in issue 251, you said Superman could do this, but in issue 307, he did it. And so like, what, there's some kind of conflict there. Like, how do you resolve that? And the editors would be like, why do we have people that read this way? This is a story. Like, why are you reading it so closely? But it was really important to my dad. And so he wrote in this letter, and my mom had actually, he lived here, and they used to print, privacy was not as important, they used to print the address, and she saw that he was in Nashville. She had gone to college in Nashville and had moved back to Mississippi, where she's from. She had read the Superman comic, she saw his letter, and she wrote to him.
This is wild.
Yeah. And so comic books are like why I exist, right?
Yes.
And so that like art form, so you know, comic books of course are just, it's art and story, right?
Right.
And so that has always been a part of me. And so I've drawn since I could hold a pencil, and I've, you know, written stories then too. You know, I had a little word processor when I was in like third grade, you know, and like wrote all kinds of weird stupid stories. And then I went to the arts high school. I went to the arts middle school and high school actually in Nashville, because I was really, really wanted to like hone that stuff. And then I, after college, instead of going into ministry with my religion degree, I started a graphic design company and did that for a long time.
Yeah.
And then I went to grad school in Seattle studying theology, but then I ended up working at the school doing creative work.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so it's always kind of been these two things that are like almost equal weight to me and equally important to me.
Huh.
But yeah, I mean, I love art. I love art history. Like I took art history classes in undergrad because I was just curious.
Yeah.
More and more curious. And, I loved it. I love the way people can tell stories through pictures and the symbolism that can be in there, and the way that pictures, the way that paintings, the way that drawings can hook you in a way that words can't.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Or that at least like it takes a lot of words to do it.
Yeah.
Unless they're really skilled, you know? But like there's something about pictures, there's something about really well done art. And that's why I think comics are so cool, is because it is a story in art. And you're experiencing events through still images, you know. Movies are incredible. I love movies. I love TV. I love really good cinematography.
Right.
But there is something about someone sitting down and themselves drawing out an entire world.
About that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, speaking of like images, pictures, art that kind of transcends words, is there a piece, like a piece of art that you always kind of like come back to as like, this thing,
oh man,
this is the thing. Like for me, this is the thing that really.
There are two, and it's going to be very general because I can't remember the specifics of it because I haven't looked at my art history book in a while.
Right.
But I love anything Salvador Dali did.
Okay.
Because it is wild.
Yeah.
And he took, you know, if you don't know Dali, look him up, because I can't possibly even describe it really, but it's just he took these surreal elements and made them look so realistic, but you know, had melting clocks and had just things that made no sense, and you know, animals with long legs and all the stuff that just like it works and it looks realistic, and yet it doesn't make sense.
Right.
The other one is, there's a triptych that is heaven, limbo, and hell, and it's from, I think, the 1600s.
Wow.
And it's just incredibly detailed. And it has all these, you know, the theology of it is really interesting to me. But then the other piece that's really interesting is how detailed and how many scenes are in this triptych.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
So those are kind of the two things that I think of as like, this is what I love about what art can do.
Ah, that's good.
Yeah.
That's real good. Okay. So you went to Lipscomb, or school here in Nashville, Lipscomb University,
mm-hmm.
and you end up in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there's lots of grad schools
right.
in the U.S.
Yeah.
How did this Southern boy from Middle Tennessee said yes to Seattle
mm-hmm.
and make your way out there? Like what was that whole, like why that place mm-hmm. versus the other places that you could have gone?
For me, I had been here for 25 years. I'd been in Nashville 25 years. And, you know, Lipscomb's here. So I'd grown up here. I'd gone to college here. I'd started adult life here. And I'd gotten to a place with working in graphic design that I realized, like, this is not really what I want to do full time for the rest of my life. I love doing this when I enjoy it. But, I love having this skill. But I want to do something different. And like I said, I think Lipscomb, my undergrad experience had given me the definitions of my conservative fundamentalist upbringing. What I wanted was something very different. And I wanted something that really stepped outside of that and challenged me theologically. And I wanted to really find words for my own spirituality.
Oh yeah.
That's because
what we all want, yeah.
Yeah. I had words for what I'd grown up in
mm-hmm.
and I knew where I felt different.
Yeah.
And where I believed in things that were a little slightly outside the box that I was given there. But I wanted to name what my new or, you know, what I'd found to be true about God. And yeah. So, this place called the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology up in Seattle. And everything I had read about it, I'd visited there twice at that point. Cause I really, even in undergrad, I thought I kind of want to go to school up there maybe.
Yeah.
And I'd put it behind me. But then I was like, I want to go. I feel like it's time. And so I, you know, drove across the country, to a place, you know, I didn't know anybody.
Wow.
I didn't know anybody.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And got in my Jeep with someone who I had just met, who was from Nashville, who was also going to school up there, that we had like, who had grown up with Wes, who you've had on the
oh, yeah.
podcast as well. And that's kind of how we met and drove across the country with a stranger and met a bunch of other strangers and then kind of went through a whole new process of uncovering my theological identity and my, you know, it's theology and psychology, right? That's the school. So,
right.
There's also a lot of like my own personal identity, my own personal work as well, alongside the theological work.
Yeah. So I guess the I'm always interested in what they learn from the move,
mm-hmm.
from the trip. So you made this big move, this
yeah.
big trip to a different place, different city, different culture, different relationships. So like, what was the thing looking back on that experience that you said, these were the things that I learned about maybe life or yourself
mm-hmm.
or relationships or like, what would be like one or two of the things that
yeah.
you walk away or look back on that thing and say, yeah, that's what leaving home, leaving the comfortable space, here's what it taught me.
Mm-hmm. For me, the biggest thing was that a move like that, a transition like that, it allows you to know what is actually yours and what is circumstantial, right?
Okay.
So I moved across the country. I didn't know anybody. And there were some things that, you know, I'd always had a messy car. My whole life, ever since I got my first car, it's always been messy. And then for some reason in Seattle, I kept a clean car. Don't know why.
You did.
Yeah. But it's something that like people define me And like very like loosely, you know, it wasn't like I was always the guy with messy car, but it's like, oh, Brian, he's da 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 blah blah, and he also has a messy car, and da-da, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that was one like little thing, right? But it was circumstantial. Something about my life in Nashville, I would just, you know, treated my car like a trash bin, and something about the move to Seattle, I just kind of changed and I matured and I decided not to do that anymore. And that's such a little thing. But that exposes like a host of things that sure. I learned about myself, right? Relationships. There were things that I learned that were that I did just because I was in Nashville and just because I was in the social circles I was in, that like, you know, my friendships and like the things I held important.
Like what?
That's a good question. I mean, I think about the thing I learned that was circumstantial about me in Nashville versus Seattle was that I could find people that shared passions that I had. I think in Nashville I had just kind of been like, well, these are people I hang out with, this is who I hang out with,
right,
and
right.
they may or may not be in the same stuff I'm into, but I've just known them for a long time and that's cool, right? But in Seattle I was like, oh, I can like find people that are like nerdy like me, or
right, sure.
you know, that are into the things I'm into, and that, and I could kind of pick and choose who my friend group was, really. But then there were things that were just me, right? So I made the same mistakes dating in Seattle that I made in Nashville for the most part, you know what I mean, or whatever it was. Like those types of things, I realized they're just things that are a part of who I am. They're a part of my soul. They're a part of my wounding or my gifting
yeah.
that just come with me no matter where I go, no matter who I encounter.
Oh, yeah.
Right? There's an essence of me and an essence of both my goodness and my trauma that comes with me no matter what.
Oh, yeah.
And so...
And perhaps maybe through life we can mute some of the drama and trauma.
Absolutely.
But it's still there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we can learn to be different. We
sure.
can learn, we can change.
We can change.
We can grow.
Absolutely.
But I think again, transition, what the transition taught me was it showed me there, you know, I had been in Nashville my whole life. So 18-year-old Brian and 25-year-old Brian, there were still people that knew both of them and assumed things about me from 25. The car is a good example.
Yeah.
As little as it is, but there's other things that like people just assume. It's like right. when my mom, when I was like 12, she was like, I asked for a burrito and she's like, you don't like burritos. And I was like, what are you talking about? And she's like, when you were five, you had a burrito
and you hated
and
it
made you vomit. And so you never wanted a burrito again. And I was like, well, I like them now.
I like them now.
Right. It's 7 years later.
I'm literally wearing a burrito shirt.
Yeah. It says, I like burritos.
I like burritos.
And so, you know, it's like, that's a 7 year difference. And I was like, twice my size, you know, twice the size I was before, right? I'm like, I'm a different person.
Yeah.
And that's the same amount of time between 18 and 25, right? Like, I'm a completely different person.
Yeah.
But there were people that assumed things about me that whole time. And so you realize like, oh, I can, you think you can recreate yourself. That's the other thing. You think you can recreate yourself.
Okay.
But you can't really. But you do learn the things that are circumstantial.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. And we're not like professional counselors or anything, but I'm always curious as why is it so hard for us to let people be different and change? Like, why does someone want you to keep being messy car Brian?
Right.
Or Brian that doesn't eat burritos? Like, why can't you show up and say, I keep a clean car, I love burritos, and I am kind to people always. Like,
yeah.
But it's like, no, that's not who you are. What do you think that's, I don't know. I'm so curious about that.
If I make a bold claim, I would say it's because if I change who I am, whatever it is, I am calling into question, you know, like if I have for 25 years acted one way,
mm-hmm.
and I realize, you know, oh God, like, you know, I think about like addicts all the time, right? They're like, I've been drinking my whole life and then I have to change and it becomes something that's not a part of their identity anymore. Right.
right?
And so, they figure out a new way of being out of that, you know, a new way of interacting with themselves and their identity. Or people that change religions, or people that come out with their sexuality, or yeah, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
These are things that are defining for us. And it also, the scary thing for a lot of people that never want to change, that like are very comfortable in their life, or at least have made decisions that they think make them comfortable,
right,
is that seeing other people change, seeing other people make decisions, makes them feel like they need to, well, maybe I haven't made the right decisions. Maybe I do need to change something about myself.
Yeah.
And they'd rather not think about it. We would all rather think we've made all the right decisions all down the road, right? But we, you know, because we've accumulated all this stuff, we've accumulated all this baggage about who we are and what we care about and what is important to us. And if we realize maybe something is not, something shouldn't be important to us anymore, or that ideology should be questioned.
Oh yeah.
It, you know, it's like the Jenga tower. It's like, how many of these can I take out before I crumble?
Yeah. Right? Well, and it's the assumption that, so what if it crumbles?
Right.
If it's the game of Jenga, guess what you can do? You can build the Jenga back up.
Yeah. But also I think it's a false premise that it's like Jenga.
Well, sure.
You know what I mean? It's actually, it's
a terrible game anyway. Yeah.
There's a shell around us. There are these words that have been placed on us. There are these ideas that have been placed on us, whatever they are. You know, some of them are good, some of them are neutral, some of them are bad, and we develop them over time from our community.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, like, some of those need to be washed out. Some of these need to be taken off. And the truth is that there is, you know, it's like the Russian nesting doll.
Yeah.
It's like those are the pieces on the outside, and then there is still like you, your soul or whatever you want to call it, your essence.
Yeah.
That is still in the middle there that can't actually be defined. And that's the thing, is that I am that essence. And as much as people want to put words and labels on that, I'm a shifting thing. I am that essence.
Yeah.
And the truth is that the labels help me communicate with other people and help me have relationships with other people. But that essence, you know, is what actually matters. And so all the labels that people put on me to help identify me, to help have a relationship with me, to help understand me,
sure,
are just that. They're relational. They're not defining. They're actually not, you know, they're not at the core of who I am.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So, okay, here's what I want to ask.
Solve that one.
Done. Check. Mark.
Did it.
Mentors.
Yeah.
I feel like you've got like some takes on the power of mentors.
Yeah.
What it means to be a mentee or a mentor to someone.
Mm.
'Cause I feel like you've lived a life that has had some really good ones. I mean, you mentioned your father.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's countless others. And I almost find that when people have really, when they start off with great mentors, i.e. their father, you know, or mother or something like that, then they tend to seek out and want to find other mentors that are good. But sometimes it doesn't work, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes you find not so helpful ones, or ones that let you down, or ones that you let down and don't know how to get back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I just wonder what your take is on, as someone who has dealt in a lot of different spaces in life, what's your take on that?
Well, I've had amazing mentors, and I've also, what I would say is that of all the things you just listed, I think, and to put it just like very succinctly, like I have let down a lot of my mentors, or I have gotten to a place where my mentors, where it became, something happened, like I... And what I've realized is that there's a point where with a mentor you become more peers.
Right.
And at that point, it's important to realize that.
There you go.
It doesn't always happen. But what I found was that with a lot of my mentors, I have wanted to, I've ended up wanting to work with them on kind of a peer level.
Right.
And, you know, they kind of, you know, there's that old saying, like, never meet your heroes, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not the same, it's not the same thing, but it is a lesson I have learned about my mentors who have all been great. And it's not really their fault, it's my fault. Mm. I've realized as I've kind of gone through, there's a point where I want to be seen as an equal. And I work and I try really hard to be seen as an equal.
Right.
And if you've ever tried really hard to be seen as an equal to anyone, like your parents, or it doesn't go well.
It doesn't go well.
And so, you know, I'm putting my foot down about things, or I'm, you know, and so that in ways that just aren't good for the relationship, you know? Mm. And so I think what's important is that, and I think there are some relationships that can definitely transition that way. And I'm not, you know, saying that's never something you can do, but I've learned for me, for what, however it is, whatever, again, my trauma and wounding around this type of stuff, that for me, a mentor needs to remain a mentor and not be someone I rely on beyond advice and counsel. Because once it becomes a professional relationship, it gets really fraught. Because I'm wanting not just equality, but I'm wanting, like, it is almost like that, you know, they it's like what they, you know, what you want from a parent is just like unconditional, like, acceptance and love.
Right.
And they usually, there's just something there that, like, you always are like, oh, if you could just say that differently, if you could just do that. And it's the same thing with, right, with, for me, with my mentors. And so, you know, recently I've gotten to where I've been able to stave off that desire to kind of like, oh, let's work together. Now that we've come through these stages, let's work together.
Yeah.
I've been able to stop myself before I do that.
Yeah.
And maybe at one point, maybe at some point I'll be able to do that. But I think right now it's been really good for me because, I have had really good mentors, and then that happens, and then we don't talk for a few years, and then we come back together and we're like, hey, that was crazy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah. And like, it may not even be something that they realized.
Oh yeah.
Was hurt. Like, I was hurt because of my own expectations of how they would treat me.
Yep.
And then they're like, oh, I didn't even realize you were trying to do that.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize that was happening. I just thought you were, you know, I didn't understand what happened.
For we're often so bad at communicating.
Yes.
Our expectations, our feelings, our disappointments. And then what happens, like you said, the gap happens. And you don't know why the gap happens. You're like, I think I know why this person stopped reaching out, calling me, or whatever. But they've never said that. And they think something else.
Right.
And both of you are a little bit of right and a little bit of wrong.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. It's like, eventually we say, well, then it's up to you to reach out to me.
Mm-hmm.
Or then I would say, no, it's up to you to reach out to me. Like, wait a minute. Like, that's... And it's so, we're so bad at that. Just saying, hey, you really hurt my feelings.
Yeah.
Hey, you disappointed
me. Maybe,
maybe
it was nothing intentional, and maybe it wasn't even like, maybe. And so often, this is what I have realized, is that it is so often me not stating my desire clearly.
Right.
Oh boy, have I learned that, you know, in my, I just got engaged.
Hey!
And hey! Woo-woo. Yeah. It's exciting.
Have you kissed her yet?
I have. I did not kiss dating goodbye. I did not do that. We dated and we kissed. It was great.
Yeah. We definitely do not endorse kissing dating goodbye.
On this podcast?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I will not tell you that I kissed her on the second date. I may have
like a shade section of the podcast where this we're just going to throw shade. This week, here's what we're throwing shade on.
Kissing, dating, goodbye.
Oh, all or the hello, shade. Or
Shady Pat.
Shady Pat. Shady Pat segment. But, you know, with her, with my fiance, which is funny, it's cool to say.
Yeah.
I have learned.
You're going to have Oprah moment right now?
Yeah, I'm just going to tear up right now. But I have learned, stating my desire, stating my expectations,
mm-hmm,
and her doing the same is the key to the majority of our arguments.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that she's, it doesn't, by stating my desire, it doesn't even mean that she will then, you know, do that thing. It doesn't mean that I will then do that thing if she right. says her desire. It just means that we're being vulnerable and honest with each other.
Right. Oh yeah.
And with that, and that's, you know, looking back at my relationships with mentors, with all kinds of people throughout my life, that is the thing that I've learned to do most in recent years, is state my desire, be honest, be blunt, as much as that is a word that people kind of don't like.
Yeah.
They act like it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
Being blunt is actually very helpful. Be kind, but be blunt.
Yeah.
Say there's honestly yeah. what you mean.
You can be honest yeah. without being hurtful.
Yeah.
I can still tell you the truth, even though you may not like to hear it, but I can say it in a way that is still truthful
right.
and honest and direct.
And I can say my desire right. without it being on you
right.
to give me my desire.
Yeah.
And that's what's hard.
That's really hard.
It's hard on both sides. It's hard to say it, and yeah. it's hard to receive it without then having to act on it
mm-hmm.
or feeling. And both sides of that can create a lot of resentment. So it takes a lot of health and a lot of therapy and a lot of good stuff and a lot of failure yeah. to get there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think with a lot of my relationships, especially my mentor relationships, I've seen that happen a lot, is kind of my resentment build because I have not said the thing I want from them.
Yeah.
And they don't understand it. We were fine 6 months ago with like grabbing coffee every few weeks. And now all of a sudden you want to, whatever, yeah. you know, now all of a sudden you want to like co-write a book with me. I don't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm the one wanting them to co-write a book with me.
Yeah. yeah.
So, you know, it's that kind of thing.
Huh? So, okay. That was great. That's great. That's good stuff. So we have to spend, I know we're maybe getting close to time, but mm-hmm. we got to talk about you are not only this comic book aficionado. I'm saying that word wrong.
It's you're very close.
I'm very close.
Aficionado.
I think
it was an N.
Yeah. Comic books, yeah. your thing. You're good. You know your stuff.
Yeah.
Also, Kanye West is your thing.
Well, yeah. It's a hard time. I don't know when this is coming out. He might do something terrible. Who knows?
So I just want you to, you know, as the kids say, I want you to flex on uh-huh. comic books and what you see happening in comic book world, even the comic book movie universes that we're creating,
sure.
what you know, and I would love to even know what your dad's thoughts on the treatment Superman has been getting lately, like in movie form. You know, I'm sure he's struggled to
hot take dad. I would say dad and me agree on this. We're going to go. If we're talking about Man of Steel,
yep.
Batman versus Superman, Justice League. Those are the three like most recent depictions of Superman.
Yeah.
Roof stuff. but I'll give you the order that I think they're the best at. I think Batman versus Superman better than the other three. I'm going to say it. Batman versus Superman better than the other three.
But the end then, was so bad.
Then like Justice League and Man of Steel. I don't know which one's better. Maybe Man of Steel, because it was just consistently awful, and Justice League like was clearly trying to be something, and it didn't quite work.
But It gave us Wonder Woman.
Batman vs. Superman gave us Wonder Woman.
Oh, it did?
Ah!
Oh! Dang it.
So that would... I think my dad would agree with me on that order.
Okay.
I don't need to get into all the whys. But
sure.
Yeah, Superman's had a rough go. DC has had a rough go. Marvel's had a great go.
Yeah, which is weird.
It is weird.
So I guess, yeah. and with the Kanye thing, I was curious about. It's like, okay, Kanye, he's had his recent stuff, whatever, yeah. right?
But, which is kind of his Man of Steel through Justice League moment that Superman's had too in the pop culture. Kanye's kind of had that moment right. for the past. I don't know how long we're going to go back.
Yeah. But I guess what was the start for you? Because, like, it's such a mm-hmm. interesting thing that up to the stuff that happened with him and all the stuff in media,
yeah.
you were like one of Kanye's biggest fans. You knew the ins and outs of like his music. Like, what was it?
I wrote
that,
a paper on him in grad school.
Yeah. What? Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So let me start with the most recent, because I just want to say I still am Kanye's probably one of his biggest fans. I just refuse to allow him to affect my politics. Like, I don't go to him for politics.
Yeah.
Why would you? Like, you know what I mean?
It's true.
I'll just say hot take on the whole thing is it's interesting that, like, I would love it if he came out and just said, this was all a happening. Like, I was all just like, just seeing what you guys would do.
Right.
Cause I said, George Bush don't like black people in 2005
Absolutely.
Or whatever. Yeah. And then I just said, make America great again. And the same people hated me the whole way through. And just more people got on board the second time. Right. So like, I would be interested to see, like, if you, like, it didn't change anything. Like, whether on politics, if he's, they hated him the whole time.
Yeah. That's
so
great.
So that's that. The other thing I'll say about Kanye is I think he is a musical genius and that's it. And that's like, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if Salvador Dali had wanted to be on the UN, I don't think it would have been a good idea. He was crazy in other ways, just like Kanye West is. But Kanye West is a musical genius.
Yeah.
He does, his production style is incredible. And the things he's made fun of, he consistently, like, he came out with 808s and Heartbreaks. And you tell me Drake is not famous because of 808s and Heartbreak.
That is definitely why Drake is famous.
Yeah. Now, everybody made fun of Kanye for how emo 808s and Heartbreak was. But Drake came out of that exact same thing.
Oh, absolutely.
That emo, whatever.
Talk rap,
yeah.
all that, yeah.
And so, like, and then you look at, like, Yeezus. I mean, just all the things that have been... He's just ahead of the curve, and he sets the curve, and he tells you what's coming, and every time, I think he's brilliant in that way. I do not expect him to be smart about politics.
Right.
Like, why would he? He has too much other stuff to do.
Yeah,
like, and I wish he would focus there and just let the other stuff go. But I think he's brilliant. I think he, you know, my grad paper on him was about how the way that white America has dealt with him is the way white America generally, and especially like conservative fundamentalist church America, white America in that context, deals with black people very generally. And
detail.
That like, oh, I'll let you read my paper.
No.
But there is like, there's something to it that you just see this, the way that they so quickly go to him being the monster was a great example of what he did. He knows what's going on. He has something in the zeitgeist, because Monster, if you listen to that song, he is naming it. That is after he had done the thing to Taylor Swift at the VMAs, right? That's
right.
After literally everyone in America was like, he is the worst. How could he do that to that little blonde girl? How dare he? Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And it's like, isn't how dare he do that to that little blonde girl? Like, how many black men have Ooh. Been killed for that Ooh. Statement? You know
yes.
what I mean? And so that was, you know, there's, and so when he did Monster, and uh-huh. it's just this banger song, and it's just like, but the metaphor that he puts forward is exactly.
Wow.
Like, It is a pulse on, like, this is how you guys are treating me, because I was drunk at an awards show that none of you care about. The VMAs, who cares?
Yeah.
But because I got up, you know, and so that's what,
that's
my hot take on Kanye.
Yeah.
And so I just think he represents something. He represents a lot of things. I go on about this forever. He represents a lot of things about millennials. He's not, I don't think he's technically a millennial, or he's like an older millennial.
Yeah.
Or he might be right on the cusp, but the way he is a genius, but feels like a victim. And I say this as a millennial, the way he, thinks he's super special, but also clearly like needs everyone's approval, and the way he, you know, just all of it. He's just, he's like the, he's everything about this generation, I think, in one person, in the way that he's interacting with culture.
Wow.
And I think it's really telling. Huh. And so, and also he makes banging music. It is so good. So that's how I feel about Kanye.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That's fair. That's fair.
Yeah. It's also how I feel about Dave Matthews Band. I'm a diverse person. Yeah. We don't have to talk about it. I know. Whatever. I just want to say I like a diverse things.
Wait. You feel the same?
No, not the same. Not the same. But in terms of he makes banging music and maybe I don't care as much about his politics. Yeah.
Okay. That's okay, cool. Sure. That threw me. You caught me off guard on that one. I also
saw Brad Paisley the other day in Nashville, and I said, thank you so much for Mud on the Tire. So I'm an enigma, man. I'm an enigma. I'm all over the place.
What did he say? What did he say to you when you said, thanks for Mud on the Tires?
He said, thanks, man. I said, I grew up in Nashville. I did not like country music.
Yep.
I was driving in the rural Tennessee one night, like driving, I think either I was driving to Knoxville or driving to Atlanta, and I was flipping on the radio and I heard this song, Mud on the Tires, and I was like, what is this? I actually kind of like this. This is kind of a banger. And I turned it up, and then of course it kind of faded out because I was driving past where the radio hit in. And then when I got back to Lipscomb, it was at a time when you could download anyone's music who was on the Wi-Fi in the dorm.
Yep.
And I saw, oh, Mud on the Tires. Is that song? And then I found it. And it opened me up to being okay with
country music.
Yeah. Huh. And so, like, I don't know that I would love or be, like, clued in on, like, Jason Isbell or Sturgill Simpson if I hadn't listened to Mud on the Tires that day. So I told him that, and he was like, man, that's awesome. Thank you.
Wow.
You know? So that's it, man. That's great. I'm all over the board.
So, okay, before we get out of here,
sure.
I want to know.
You asked me something about comics, too.
Yeah. So maybe before we get out of here, I want to talk about just what are you up to now? What do you kind of see? You know, you're getting married, but what do you kind of see your work in the world looking like, or generally speaking? You don't have to get, you know, detailed. And then after you kind of talk about that a little bit, I want to do kind of a quick speed round and then we'll be done.
I mean, what I'll say is, you know, just to, we've kind of talked through most of my autobiography. The end of my time at Seattle School is that I went into a very depressed time and I ended up not being able to do the work anymore. And so I had to leave because I was like, you know, I talked to the people and I just couldn't do it. And I was depressed. And so I moved back to Nashville to kind of figure out what I was doing. And I've kind of been in that space now, trying to sort it out, figure it out. So what I don't know the specifics of it. What I know to be true is that I am passionate about people's unique diversity, which is like kind of sounds oxymoronic, but it's like the way that people, everyone has the image of God that comes out in the way that they are unique and special. That to me is vital to the future of the church, to the future of our culture.
Yeah.
Allowing diversity to persist and allowing people to have voice that wouldn't normally have voices, I think is vital. And so that to me is huge. So I want that. I want diversity in all kinds of areas, sexuality, gender, denominational diversity, even religious diversity, spirituality, certainly political ideology, all this stuff. I think it's so vital to hear from different people. I also just really believe very deeply that God is not angry.
Right.
That the wrath of God is not something that has to be satisfied. And that actually it is our hatred of ourselves that God entered into history through Christ to expunge.
Yeah.
Which is a heavy statement.
Yeah.
But that to me is the gospel. And that is the gospel I want to spread. Because I feel like what has happened in fundamentalism is that God is angry with you and he died for you because he loves you. But now remember that you're terrible and that you have to earn that death, even right. though it was freely given. Like it's all these contradictory things. And I just believe really strongly that God just loves us as we are in our uniqueness, in our diversity, wants us to flourish as people. And that's like the self-hatred that is innate to us as humans that we put on other people all the time and our tribalism and our whatever, that's what he came to get rid of. And that's what I want through whatever work, whatever it is. That's what I want
to do.
And I also want to continue to be creative and tell stories and help other people tell stories, help other voices be heard, and also just talk about how awesome comic books are for that in that yeah. way. I'm passionate about that medium as a storytelling tool.
That's good.
So I think that, but that's like, what do I want my life to look like? I want it to be about helping people's stories and helping people's uniqueness thrive and be out in the world in a way that just historically it's been hard to get the diversity of voices out there.
Yeah.
And so it's amazing to see when a diverse group of people are creative, the amazing worlds that are created, the things that their imaginations can do when it's not somebody that looks like me, that acts like me, that thinks like me, that grew up like me, the imagination that they have wows me and it blows me away. And so I want to help that spread as much as I can, you know?
I love it. Love it, Brian. Okay. Speed round.
Speed round.
Favorite Nashville restaurant?
Wow. Lachlan Table.
Boom. Best comic book series?
Ouch.
Yeah.
Best comic book series?
Yeah.
I'm going to say of the year. Of the year. All time is hard for me.
Okay.
I'm going to say of the year, Mr. Miracle.
Okay. Tell us about a time where you saw something, you experienced something, and at the end of what you saw or experienced, you said, wow.
A time when I experienced something and at the end of it, I said,
wow. Or you saw something, and at the end of seeing it or experiencing that, you said, wow.
I saw a play when I was in high school that has not been produced since. By a guy named Marcus Humman. He wrote it and it's called Francis of Guernica. And it layers, Marcus Humman is a songwriter in Nashville and it layers the story of Francis of Assisi and Pablo Picasso.
What?
Together in a musical. And if I could tell you that's why I love theater. We didn't even talk about theater, but I love theater. I mean, I was a theater kid in high school too. And that to me was like the way people talk about Hamilton today, like for me in that moment, that was my Hamilton. Yeah. Francis of Guernica. I don't even think it's published. I don't think people even perform it anymore, but Marcus Humman wrote it. He's a songwriter in Nashville. I met him one time and I said, that play was amazing. He was like, what? Because it was like a one run thing at TPAC.
Wow.
But it blew me away and I thought it was amazing.
I said, wow. Huh.
Yeah.
It's good. I think that's good. Anything else we need to cover? You want to, any shout outs you want to give? Anything you need to say?
Shout out. I got no shout outs. Shout out to Kelly.
Yeah.
My fiance.
Big day.
Yeah, big day.
Okay. Coming.
Shout out to Kanye.
Shout out to Kanye.
Shout out to Kanye West.
Oh, here's one. Most overrated and most underrated rapper, hip hop artist right now.
Most overrated and underrated.
Uh-huh. Because you love hip hop. I know you love hip hop.
Yeah. It's hard for me to know underrated. But I want to say underrated, because rapper.
Underrated.
Rapper. Underrated rapper, Childish Gambino. Because he's gotten famous now for R&B.
Right.
but he's a great rapper.
Yeah.
So like,
okay,
that's what I'd say. Underrated, Childish Gambino. Overrated, guess what I'm going to say? It's Drake. No question. Drake is the most overrated. I'm not saying he's terrible, but he's overrated.
Michael Jordan or LeBron?
Ooh. I'm LeBron.
All right.
I don't watch sports, and I watch the decision.
That's true. All right.
Like, come on.
Cool. Thanks, Brian. This has been great.
No problem. Michael Jordan or LeBron?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, LeBron.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I figured.
Easy. All right. Thanks. We'll see y'all.